I don't have quite enough hands for this, but except for that, it'll be okay. Now, what we have here to start are a few pictures, and then as usual, I'm going to switch to chalk. So, of course, now my pointer doesn't work, but I don't want to bother to change the batteries right now. So, what we have here is a picture. This is with two different pictures with two different mechanisms, although this may be a diagram, but I think they're both pictures. The thing on the left is red blood cells, except this time they're properly colored with hemoglobin instead of looking white, black and white. But the other two pictures show you the spectrin-ankyrin web and how it is organized if you're looking from the outside of the cell. So this would be spectrin, and there are six spectrins connected at a vortex, which is made of a short actin filament. Now, this comes from a paper in which they engineers actually figured out that that thing sticking up in the middle is the microfilament, and it's connected to the six actins. And the idea is red blood cells have to be very flexible because they have to squeeze through the capillaries. And the question is, how do you deform the membrane and yet keep it strong? And the idea is that this microfilament can swivel like a baseball bat, allowing that section to deform and springing back up again. Now, this is just for fun. The red is spectrin, and the green is the Golgi, stained in two different ways. And their point is that this is a cell, which is an epithelial cell. So this is the edges. The cell is sort of cuboidal. And you can see that there is spectrin around the edges, and it's in a different place than the Golgi. Now, this is something we were talking about at the end of class last time. We were talking about the extracellular matrix, and we went very quickly. So I wanted to say just a few more words about it. That this is actually from a plant cell, but the idea is similar in that you have transmembrane proteins, in this case, integrins, who are connected on the inside to the cytoskeleton. And on the outside, they are connected to the extracellular matrix. And the extracellular matrix, remember, has three kinds of proteins in it. And one kind is these strong connecting proteins like collagen, and this is collagen, which provides largely strength. And then you have these so-called adhesive proteins that glue everything together. And this is an adhesive protein. In an animal cell, probably it would be fibronectin. And this protein connects both to the transmembrane protein and to the components of the extracellular matrix. All this stuff outside the cell on the top is extracellular matrix. Now, the third component here, which is the one probably we didn't have time to talk about at all, is the proteoglycan, the material which is a lot of carbohydrate on a little protein and that acts to absorb water and form a gel. So the way it works is this little branch structure here is one proteoglycan. So this is the protein part. And the things that stick out are the long carbohydrate chains, the repeating ones, A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, which are called GAGs for glycoaminoglycan. All that's written down in your notes. Or they're also called mucopolysaccharides. So this little tree here is one proteoglycan. But sometimes they're all stuck together to make a complex, and they're all stuck to this basic chain here, and this is another carbohydrate. This is another polysaccharide, not a protein. So in this whole big blue mess, it's only these little side branches, the original one, which is protein. Everything else is carbohydrate. Now, I should mention that these pictures are not yet on CourseWorks, but will be. Now, I think before I leave this, are there any questions about this picture before I leave it? Okay. So I think we have one more picture here. Oh, yes, important one. We're going to be talking today about epithelial cells. which are the kinds of cells that make up the linings of your body, both on the outside and around the spaces in your body, like around your lungs and around your digestive tract. And these cells are what are called polarized cells because their two ends are different, just as microfilaments are polarized. Their two ends are different. You can see that the top end here is different from the bottom end of the cell. In this picture, the top is the part that would be facing the lumen or a space, and the rest of the body would be down here. And one of the, we're going to show, go over a lot of this, but you notice that these cells, this is a cutaway, these cells are connected to each other. And the top four things here are four kinds of connections, which we're about to talk about, and which are diagrammed on your handout. And then down here, this is part of the cytoskeleton. This is a connection to the extracellular matrix. These cells, remember, are lining a cavity, and their extracellular matrix is not on the top, but on the bottom. So this extracellular matrix here between this part and the next layer of cells. And here, one of the parts of the extracellular matrix they have that we talked about last time is the basal lamina. So extracellular matrix can be this sort of amorphous web like we showed in the previous picture, but parts of the extracellular matrix form a mat, and that's what this is. It would come out this way with the cells sitting on top. And it is largely a web of laminin and collagen. It has other proteins, but those are the two main ones. And you have here also connections, not only from cell to cell, but from cell to the basal lamina. And we're going to talk about that kind of connection today, too. Okay, so there's a picture like this in all books, of course, and there's a picture like this on your handout, and we'll go over it in a bit. And now the only other slide that I have today is one that really I should have shown yesterday, which is just a beautiful picture of red blood cells containing hemoglobin and in color. So now we're going to turn off the slides and go back to chalk. Now, the first thing that I want to talk about today are largely junctions between two cells. And they're diagrammed, the various kinds, are diagrammed on 4A on the top. Now, let's just sort of list the basic kinds, and then we'll talk about them in more detail. There are three kinds shown here on the top, and they are called gap junctions, tight junctions, and adhesive junctions. And adhesive junctions, as it says on the table on the bottom, are also known as anchoring junctions. Now, all three of these share the same basic setup. There are details of difference, which we're going to talk about, but first let's talk about the part that's common to all of them. You have one cell with its bilayer and another cell with its bilayer. You notice that's the same in all three pictures. And then you have some sort of transmembrane protein in each cell in the membrane. That is a protein that goes all the way through. And these proteins are almost always linked to the cytoskeleton directly or indirectly. It's clear in some pictures and not in others, and it's more emphasized for some structures than for others. And these two proteins are generally the same, but they connect to each other. So they interlock to form a join between the two cells. But the join is between two similar proteins in this case, not between two different proteins. When you have a receptor and a ligand, they're usually different, and they match up like an enzyme and substrate. But here you have two things that lock together. perhaps like hooks, like in the third picture, the middle picture, where you see that each protein is the same, but the net result is that they hook together. Or to use the more common demonstration. So now let's look at these three different cases, because in each case you have different proteins, and therefore you have a different distance between the two cells. They're anchored to different parts of the cytoskeleton, and they serve different functions. So let's look first at gap junctions, which is the first one shown here on the upper left, and that looks sort of like the picture I just drew. Now, these were named gap junctions because the cells are close to each other, but there's still a small gap between them. The thing that's sort of strange is that the thing with a bigger gap is called something else. So I guess what's surprising about this is that there's a gap at all. And the gap is quite small. It's on the order of 2 to 4 nanometers. Now, what these proteins are that make the connection, these proteins are actually hollow. So they're actually short tubes. Damn. The thing must have batteries, but I'm not sure how you do it. Yeah, what do you know? Question is, how many? Let's hope there's only one. But I always bring batteries. They have them here, but I don't trust them. Oh, it's two. Okay. Let's see if that does the trick. Yep, that did it. Okay, that did that. So now let's go back to it. The point is that each of these, this is actually a protein complex. The protein here is called connexin. And connexin subunits assemble to form a structure, a tube, which is called a connexon. And I think I have a pretty good model for that. So this would be a piece of the cell membrane. As you can imagine, the rest of the cell is here. And this is a piece of membrane. And you have this connexon, this bagel or torus-like structure, which goes all the way through. It's actually a little more elongated than this if you look at real dimensions. But it goes through both sides of the membrane. Now, this model is perhaps not as good as it should be because the bagels keep getting bigger and bigger. And so they don't have to keep making my hole bigger and bigger. And there wouldn't be extra pieces of membrane tucked over here. This would just be sticking in the middle of the membrane. Now, each of the cells would have something like this. So the two cell surfaces would come up against each other. And the two connexons then would join. Now, notice this leaves a space or a gap between the cells. Because the connexons stick out and form the little tube in between, there's a space in here, and that's the gap in a gap junction. But the result is that you have a pore or a hole that connects the cytoplasm of one cell to the cytoplasm of the next. So a connexon makes up a kind of pore or channel. And it's just large enough for small molecules and ions to move from one cell to the next. So it allows the passage of nutritional things like glucose and ions that carry a current from a current or a change in polarity from one part, from one cell to another. Now, most, if not all, pores and channels like this are what is called gated. And that means, although they are hollow, and they form a connecting tube. They can be closed, probably by putting a flap of protein on the end, so that the cell can control the flow of materials through. Now, are materials going to go in one direction or the other? It's actually going to be both. It's going to be driven by the concentration of the material. If you have a higher concentration on this side, it will flow into the left. If you have a higher concentration on this side, it'll flow to the right. So the primary function then of gap junctions is for the transport to be used either for nutrition or signaling. Now, the function of tight junctions, which is type number 2 on the upper right, is quite different. These actually serve to make a seal. Now, the difference here is at the point where the two membranes meet, there is no gap. So the transmembrane protein does not really stick out of the membrane very far. So when the two come together and lock, when the two proteins lock, you have basically fused the two membranes. Now, therefore, although there is a space here and a space there, at the point where the protein is, there is no gap. And notice at the point where the protein is here, there is a gap. The two membranes are not touching. Now, we have a model sort of for that too. This is the best way to explain this one. So this would be the surface of one cell. This would be the surface of the other cell. Now, when you have tight junctions, you might think that you just slam the two cells up against each other and they're completely sealed, but they're not. They're only sealed at points where that little protein is. So the protein we're talking about is found in the membrane along ridges. So there would be a ridge here, and there would be a matching ridge on the other side. So that, I have to orient these properly, goes this way, so that they look matching. And if I put them together then, there would be a ridge of joined membrane along here, etc., along each line. Now, there's usually a band of these ridges going around the cell. And the larger the band is, the better a barrier it is. Now, what's the point of this? The idea is that if you have liquid, water, coming through here, it isn't going to make it across. If you have a whole branching series of bands or ridges of these beads, then liquid cannot get through from one side to the other. So if you have a bunch of cells next to each other joined in this way, they form a barrier. And liquid cannot get across in the holes between them. And we have a 3D model of that in a little bit. Now, another way to think about this is what would happen if you did freeze fracture. So now, this is one membrane. But remember, a membrane is a bilayer. So this is one cell. And suppose we were to free fracture this. What would we see? Now, remember that what we're looking here is the way we want to do it. Let me be sure to get it right here. I never did this one before, so I want to be sure I have it right. So if this is the cell, cytoplasm, and we crack it open, this would be the P face. That would be the E face. Now, what you see is you see ridges on the P and you see grooves on the E. What does that mean? What's anchored? These proteins must be anchored because
When you freeze fracture along here, the protein tends to go with the cytoplasmic side. So that these proteins must be anchored, although it's not in an obvious and direct way. Now, when you do freeze fracture, sometimes these are so close that sometimes the plane goes like this. And in some of the pictures in your book, you sometimes see these pictures. And the reason it's interesting is, okay, I do freeze fracture, I get two halves. So let's say I pull this half off. Now what I'm going to see then, if I'm looking from the top, is I'm going to see this, and then I'm going to see this. I'm going to see the P face from one cell, because I'm looking from that side, and then I'm going to see the E face from this cell. And that allows you, in a single picture sometimes, to see the inside of a P and the inside of an E in the same picture because of this. Now, tight junctions are thought to serve two important functions. One is that liquid cannot indiscriminately move across. So a bunch of cells connected this way make up a barrier. But the other thing is that if there is a band of tight junctions around a cell, such as, say, this, the green tape represents a band of tight junctions. It means that the proteins on one side of the green tape cannot diffuse through the membrane. They cannot move laterally to the other side of the green tape. So all the proteins in this part have to stay in this part of the cell. And all the proteins up here have to stay in this part of the cell. So it acts as a kind of boom to block movement across. So it locks the proteins in. And so this leads to the very interesting question, in a polarized cell, how do you send a protein to the right end in the first place? Once it gets there, the tight junction keeps it from straying into the other part. But how do you direct it? And we'll talk about directions later. Now, before we talk more about whole cells, we want to go back now and look at this other form of connection and at cell extracellular membrane connections. So there's one more kind on your picture on the top, and that's an adhesive junction. So I'll draw that one over here. Now, it starts the same way, that you have the two opposing membranes, and you have a transmembrane protein that sticks out, and it connects. Now, remember I mentioned that there was a kind that had a larger gap. This has quite a large gap, on the order of 35 nanometers. The function of this kind of junction is quite different from that of a gap junction. There is no pore extending from one cell to the next. This is just a kind of glue or connection or cable that will connect the two. Now, in order for this to work, clearly these proteins have to be anchored. If what you're doing is locking two cells together, they have to be anchored, like my hands are at the elbows, in order to hold the whole thing up. So you'll notice in your picture, and this is characteristic of most adhesive junctions, that the protein is connected to the cytoskeleton, but it's not connected directly. There is a linker protein in the middle. And in many cases, the linker protein forms a dense substance known as plaque. Now, in some adhesive junctions, the plaque is not visible in the electron microscope, but there's clearly a linker protein. So we have to put the one in the other one side, too. Now, there are two kinds of adhesive junctions that have a similar structure. Now, all of them have a similar protein in the middle. The protein here in the middle is a cadherin. That's a family of proteins, and it's one of them. The protein here is connexin. And the protein here is a different one. I don't so much care that you remember the name as that I want you to realize it's not cadherin. It's something else. It happens to be the primary protein here is what's called a claudin. Now, these are primarily involved in strength, and they vary in what part of the cytoskeleton they're connected to and in what shape they have. So now if you look at the bottom of your handout, you see there's a little table. So the top half of it talks about cell-cell connections, and it says adhesive or anchoring junctions. And it says that the transmembrane protein is a cadherin, just like we said. But it says the cytoskeleton, this part of the cytoskeleton it's linked to, can be either intermediate filaments or microfilaments. That's the big difference. Now, these two kinds of connections usually differ in size. Usually, the connections to intermediate filaments form a kind of spot, which is called a spot desmosome. In this case, what we mean is there'd be a small circle of plaque, and many molecules of cadherin would come out of it and link to many molecules of cadherin on the other side. But it would form a kind of button-shaped plaque here and would be attached to intermediate filaments. The other kind of adhesive junction is attached to microfilaments, and it usually takes the form of a belt. And it's just called an adherence junction instead of a desmosome. This is written, of course, in your table. Now, in that case, what would happen is you'd have a belt going all the way around the cell like this, and there'd be a belt on the opposing cell, and the little hooks would stick out all along the belt here, and there'd be hooks on the matching belt. And they'd be connected to microfilaments inside the cell. So, with many epithelial cells, remember we showed that picture, there were a whole bunch of junctions, one after another. So what we're talking about by a belt is that this would be tight junctions, but this would be an adhesive junction. This would be an adherence junction or a belt. So there would be these little hooks sticking out all along here and little hooks sticking out all along here, and they would lock. But now if you looked inside along here, you would see a thickening of that plaque or intermediate linker protein, and then it would be connected to microfilaments. And the microfilaments are thought to go around, not across, but around the cell. Whether this has any contractile value, nobody knows. Now, before we leave this whole business about how you glue anything up to anything else, we want to consider another kind of junction. Everything we've talked about so far connects one cell to its neighbor. But as we saw in that picture, that epithelial cells at least, and it turns out many other cells as well, are sitting on top of a basal lamina. So my sponge here would be the basal lamina. And there has to be a connection between the bottom of the cell and the basal lamina. And there is. And the connections between the bottom and the basal lamina, or in general, between the cell and the extracellular material, are similar, but not exactly the same to what we've been talking about. That the two types of connections to the extracellular matrix parallel the two types of adhesive junctions that we just talked about.
And that's why if you look at the bottom of 4A, you see there's another column in your table that this is cell-to-cell connections, and then it has cell-ECM connections. Now, there's a picture of this in the middle of your handout, and you notice that it looks sort of like half an adhesive junction, that you have a hook sticking out, you have a linker, and you have cytoskeleton. And again, this is either intermediate filaments or microfilaments, depending on the case. And then instead of this hook being hooked to the next cell, protein in the next cell, it's hooked to some component of the extracellular matrix. So I just put this in. This is some protein in the extracellular matrix. Now, just as all three cell-cell connections have their unique transmembrane protein, so this kind of connection has a different transmembrane protein. And one of the most common ones, you notice, usually they're integrants. So on your handout, on the little table, cell-cell connections of this kind use cadherin, but cell-extracellular connections use integrants. And these are extremely interesting proteins because not only do they hold things together, but they're thought to be involved in signaling. And if you watch the inner life of the cell, you see these proteins, and there's a picture of this in Sadava, they're sort of scrunched up like this, and at the critical moment, they straighten out. They sort of blossom up. And that's supposed to be involved both in their making connections and in their carrying signals. So integrins turn out to be very important proteins. Now, just as adherence junctions, I should say adhesive junctions, have two varieties, desmosomes and adherence junctions. So this kind of junction can be connected either to intermediate filaments or to microfilaments. In the same way, the integrins can be connected through a linker to either microfilaments or to intermediate filaments. And you get two different kinds of connections, which are listed on the bottom of your handout. One kind of connection just looks like half a desmosome. There's a little button of plaque. They're intermediate filaments. And there's integrin instead of cadherin, but basically the structure looks very similar. And that's called a hemidesmosome. So a hemidesmosome is parallel to a desmosome, except one connects to the next cell and one connects to the extracellular matrix. Now, similarly, there is something equivalent to an adherence junction or a belt adhesive junction, and that's called a focal adhesion. And in that case, you have a structure very much like this. The transmembrane protein is connected to the extracellular matrix, but it's connected to, on the inside, to microfilaments, not intermediate filaments, and plaque is usually not visible. Now, we're not going to talk very much about focal adhesions in this class. They're largely involved in cells that move, and they make them, and then as the cells move, they break them and make new ones. We're going to talk more about hemidesmosomes, which anchor epithelial cells to their basal lamina. Now, I think I'm going to stop here before I go on and ask if there are questions about any of this business. Yeah?
You're talking about tight connections. I'm confused when you said that the proteins aren't able to transverse the cell.
You say the protein here doesn't transverse the cell, but it transverses the cell membrane.
But it keeps proteins from moving within the cell?
Yes. It doesn't keep proteins from moving within the cell. Yeah, because there's a solid layer of membrane here, a continuous bilayer. And there are unique proteins embedded in this end, other transmembrane proteins or extrinsic proteins, and different ones here. Other questions?
Could a spot, bind to a belt?
Could a spot connect to a belt? As far as I know, they don't. Yeah?
Are repeating? Are they all next to each other? Or can you just...
Do they repeat or are they all next to each other? Well, in a minute we're going to put them on a real cell, and I think you'll get some sense of where they are and what they look like. So in fact, that's really what I wanted to do next, is I want to talk about how these are the kinds of connections are actually used. And before I go on, I should just mention that there are a whole bunch of diseases that come about because of defective functioning of the various proteins involved in these connections. A lot of them involve the skin. The skin is many layers on top of a basal lamina. And if the appropriate protein doesn't work, the layers don't connect properly to each other or to the basal lamina, and blistering occurs. And there are many such conditions. Some of them are genetic because the protein is improperly made because of improper instructions. Some of them occur because they're autoimmune diseases. You are not supposed to make antibodies to your own proteins, but in certain rare cases, people do. And if you make an antibody to one of these proteins, by mistake, of course, it's not supposed to, then that antibody gloms up that protein and it doesn't work. And so because of autoantibodies, sometimes you also get blistering. But now we want to consider normal cells. Now, I've mentioned epithelial cells, and I think at this point it's worth mentioning a little bit about what does a eukaryotic cell look like in a multicellular organism. At the beginning of this class, we drew a typical eukaryotic cell. Well, it turns out that there is no such thing. In your body, virtually every cell type is different from every other cell type. And people have figured out there are about 200 significantly different cell types in the human body. Now, don't worry, you don't have to know about all 200. But it turns out that they fall into four classes, or they form four tissues. Cells, we know, don't operate by themselves. They operate in a group. When you have a bunch of cells that are similar in structure and function, what they make up is called a tissue. So if you have a lump or a layer of similar cells doing their thing, that's called a tissue. And then tissues come together to form organs. Organs come together to form systems, etc., etc. So people also use tissue a different way. They say, I have a hunk of kidney tissue. Now they just mean something that came from a kidney. But kidney tissue in that sense consists of many different kinds of tissue, the different layers that would be in a kidney. Now, it turns out that although there are 200 different kinds of cells, there are really only four kinds of tissues, or four types of cells. Now, it depends whether you're a lumper or a splitter. Some people say four, some people say five. But that's it. So what are they talking about? If you take all the cells in an animal or a human, you can classify them into four categories. First of all, there's muscle. And everybody sort of knows what that means. It's true there's smooth muscle, striated muscle, and heart muscle, but it's all involved in contraction, and we'll talk about it another time. Then there's nervous tissue or nerve cells, and we know what they do. They're involved in conducting messages. And we'll talk about how they work later, too. Then there is what is called connective tissue. Now, this is a case where the individual cells are surrounded by extracellular matrix. It's not that a whole bunch of cells have a layer on one side, but each cell is surrounded by and separated from its neighbors by extracellular matrix. Now, the extracellular matrix can be solid. Bone is an example of a tissue which has a solid extracellular matrix. Or the extracellular matrix can be semi-solid, as in cartilage, which we mentioned last time. And adipose tissue, fat tissue, is also considered connective because it has a lot of extracellular matrix surrounding the cells. However, I should warn you that fat tissue stores its fat inside the cells in vesicles. It is not the padding around the cells, but the stuff inside that contributes to the bulges. Now, blood is sometimes considered connective tissue
that has a liquid matrix. You have blood cells floating in the plasma. Some people consider blood to be a fourth category, a fifth category, because there's going to be a four. That's the lumper splitter business. So it's these three and epithelial cells. And you can either put blood into connective or a separate category. Now, what are epithelial cells? They generally form the linings, as we've said earlier, of surfaces. Either your outside, like your skin, or like the surrounding the space in your intestines and your gut. Also your lungs, your kidney, etc. And these orange juice cartons are pretty good examples of epithelial cells. In that epithelial cells are polarized, that is, they have two different ends usually, because one side faces a space or the outside, and one side faces the rest of the body. And they have different sets of proteins that behave differently on the two ends. And they are usually tightly joined and packed into layers. I only have, I think, three cartons here today. My family drinks a lot of orange juice, and I probably could have more, but it takes up too much space. But what you would have is, you would have a whole layer of those connected in this dimension and connected in this dimension. Many, many, many of them making up a layer. And what we're going to do today is talk a little bit more about epithelial cells, because as shown in that picture and on your handout now, on the other side, on B, these cells contain almost all of those connections that we've talked about. Now, I just want to mention that these cells, as we've already said, usually rest on a non-cellular support like a basal lamina. And these cells also form glands. And how they and why they do that, or how, we'll discuss, and how they work, we'll discuss at another time. But today we're going to focus more on how they are connected. So if you look at the top of your handout, we're going to talk about the epithelial cells that surround the lumen or space in your digestive tract or gut. So this is meant to be a piece of your intestine. So needless to say, it is surrounded by cells. So there's a whole layer of cells all the way around, but if you did a cross-section, it would look like this, the individual cells. So as you can see on your picture, what we considered is what would happen if you took a cross-section of this. You would see something that looked like the end-on picture. Now, the truth is that the cells that surround your gut don't look quite like that. They look much more like picture three. Instead of looking sort of a layer of cells like this, it's really all folded something like this. Oops. Now, not only is it folded in this way, but each individual cell has protrusions into the space in the middle. I think we mentioned earlier that any time you have a space, either within a vesicle, within an organ, anywhere, you call it a lumen. So this is the lumen, or the space in your gut, what you eat goes into there. Now, one of these intrusions or punching ins is called a villus, and they're all called villi. That's the plural. But this is one of those situations where the fleas have fleas. So that on each cell here, there are protrusions into the lumen. So that's why on your handout it looks something like this. So if you blow up an individual cell in cross-section, it would look like that. And these are called microvilli, or this is one microvillus. So this cell is just a blow-up of this.
And what's important, as we've said, is this cell has two different surfaces with different properties. So the body is out here, around. So when we look at our individual cell, or we look at our sheet of cells, which is drawn on your handout, where there's a block with a bunch of them, the body cells are down here, and the lumen is up here. And if we drew it properly, in sort of three dimensions here, each of these cells then has microvilli on this top surface and none on the bottom, and it's resting on a basal lamina on the bottom. Now, to keep it straight, this side of the cell is called the lumen side or the apical side. And the other surface of the cell is called the basolateral, because it's resting on the basal lamina. Now, what is the point of having these villi and microvilli? This greatly, greatly increases the surface which is exposed to the lumen, because this is an area of absorption where material is absorbed across into the cell, and you have to have a large surface area so you can absorb what you eat in a reasonable amount of time. And it turns out that the surface of your intestinal, I don't know if it's just your whole digestive system or just your intestines, is the area of one tennis court. So there's a lot of surface in there because there's an infolding and infolding on the infoldings. And these microvilli are held up by microfilaments inside. And they're very nice pictures of that in your book and many on the web as well. Now, just to be sure we get all the pieces put together, on the very bottom of your handout is a diagram of two cells and a third one cut away. And this is very similar to the picture that I showed at the beginning on the PowerPoint, which comes from not your book, but a similar book, showing how all of these connections fit in. So let's take a quick look at it and see how it relates also to our OJ cartons. So the idea here is that we have these cells, and they're sort of cuboidal, like the OJ carton. So we have these cells next to each other. So from the picture we've drawn here, this would be two cells next to each other. And this would be the top with the microvilli on it. This is the apical surface, and this is the basolateral surface. And our third cell is sort of cut away so you can get some picture of what it looks like inside. Now, as shown, each of these represents sort of one orange juice cart. Now, as you can see, there is what people call a junctional complex. There's tight junctions, adherence junctions, and desmosomes, the works. So, first you have the tight junction. That's this picture here. And remember, it means that the cells are joined along a ridge. Therefore, the top proteins can't slide down and the bottom can't slide up. And then we have after that, so that's equivalent to the green tape. And then after that, we have adherence junctions. We have a belt, one of these belt adhesive junctions, represented by the green tape. And so that would be here. And remember, that's connected to microfilaments, which probably go around the cell. Now, further down, we have gap junctions between the cells. So I've drawn it here that the cells actually aren't right next to each other, but there are gap junctions that connect them. And they would be, you'd see them from the inside. You'd see the end of a tube. You'd see the inside of the bagel. So this is a double bagel here. One bagel from
one cell sticking out and hitting the bagel from the next, so that ions can travel across this sheet. So if you change the ionic conditions in any one cell in this sheet, it will change through the entire sheet. Now, the one other thing here is remember that there is a basal lamina down here, and the cells are connected to the basal lamina. And so that involves primarily hemidesmosomes. And so that would be, you'd see that if you looked at the bottom here. This would be the plaque connected to intermediate filaments, and that it would contain an integrin transmembrane protein holding to the basal lamina on the bottom. And you can't, that's not drawn, I didn't draw that there, but you certainly couldn't see it here because it would be underneath. So one more run at the cartons to be sure we've got the topology here. So in your picture, let's see, this is the cutaway one. So they look something like this. So this is the apical surface, the basolateral. Here is tight junctions, adhesive junction, belt. Then you would have desmosomes here connect, you would have desmosomes connecting here, and you would also have you would have gap junctions. I think I didn't say that clearly before, that you have both desmosomes and gap junctions connecting these two, and whatever I said before, it's the gap junction that allows material to pass from one cell to the next and makes a pore, that's the bagels. And the desmosomes provide a kind of bracing to hold this whole sheet together. I think I confabulated the two previously. So let me stop here and ask what questions there are about this. Yeah?
What's the point of the microvilli again?
The point of the microvilli is to increase the surface area of the apical side. So the villi do that, and the microvilli do it even more. So that the surface here area exposed to the liquid in the lumen is extremely large. Yeah?
Are the tight junctions always the most superficial of the junctions?
From what I understand, the tight junctions are always on the top in a setup like this, if that's what you mean. Yeah?
How do desmosomes connect cells?
How do desmosomes connect cells? Well, let's look back at our picture here, which hopefully I didn't erase. So here is our desmosome. If this were a desmosome, this would be sort of like a little spot as opposed to a big belt. But what happens is that this interlocking proteins connect one cell to the next, and then these intermediate filaments would be connected across the cell to another set to the next cell. So these, the combination of the intermediate filament acting as a sort of cable or brace plus these connectors is what holds one cell to the next. Yeah?
I understand that the tight junction stops the liquid from moving in, you know, from the intestine, but you said that the other function is that proteins diffuse. Are there any proteins in microvilli that diffuse?
Are there any proteins in microvilli? Anytime you have a membrane, you have proteins in it. They're either intrinsic or extrinsic proteins, but all membranes have a lot of protein in them. None of them are pure bilayer of lipid. So microvilli do have proteins. Yeah.
Do microvilli just sort of go up, or are they like this?
The microvilli just go up.
Okay.
So from this picture here, they would go somewhat at an angle into the lumen, but they would surround the lumen entirely. There was a question in the back? Yeah, come back to you. Yeah?
Did you say that the intermediate filaments form like a ring around the cell?
No, the intermediate filaments don't, but the microfilaments to which the adherence junction, the belt, is connected. You have two kinds of adhesive junctions. You have the belt, which is the red tape, which is thought to be connected to microfilaments, and those microfilaments go around. But then you have the spot desmosomes, which are connected to intermediate filaments. And the intermediate filaments are thought to go across the cells. And in fact, not always in a straight line, but to go at various angles to make a kind of bracing structure. Did you have a question? And then yours.
Yeah. The belt of adherence junctions doesn't divide the membrane the way the tight junctions
do. Does the belt of adherence junctions divide the membrane the way the tight junctions one does? As far as I know, the answer is no. In that proteins can move from one side of an adherence belt to the other. That it does, they're not locked by it. Now, it's true that in a setup like this, it's not really an issue. But you might say for the proteins that are in the middle here, they can, I believe, go across the adherence junction. Yes?
So the apical side faces the lumen so it can absorb nutrients?
Does the apical side face the lumen so it can absorb nutrients? Well, I think you sort of have it backwards, but yes. No, what I meant by backwards in terms of what is the function of. Things don't do anything for, they just do. It's not that the apical side is thinking, how will I absorb nutrients? It's that the structure of the apical side is such that it is able to absorb nutrients.
So how does it absorb nutrients?
How does it absorb nutrients? That's the next topic.
When they're tight.
That's a very good question. If there's a tight junction here, how can you absorb anything? It's a very good question. So the answer is that if nutrients are going to get from this side of the layer to the other side, there's only one way they can do it, and that's to go through the cells. So you have to have transport proteins in this membrane to get them into the cell, and transport membranes in the bottom to get them out of the cell into the rest of the body. And how that works, we will get to. We're going to talk about the individual transport mechanisms, and then we're going to talk about how you put it together to move stuff where you want it to go. Let's see. We have one more question, and I think we're going to stop.
Are there any junctions similar to this within the cell that connects some of the organelles?
As far as I know, there are not connections like this within the cell, but there are always proteins that stick to other proteins that hold things together. But these particular structures are found cell-cell and cell-extracellular matrix, as far as I know. So now let's consider this question of how do things get across membranes anyway? Because we've just concluded correctly that if you're going to get anything from the contents of the lumen into the body, it's going to have to go through a membrane. Now, for this part, you probably want to use the other handout, 4C. Now, we're going to discuss what's on the top, and we're going to mention a lot of the things that are at the bottom, but the thing on the bottom is largely for reference. And it may be that when I say certain things, you can just look at it and check them off, and you don't have to write them down. But it's there largely for reference. What we're going to talk about first is how you get small molecules across a membrane. How you get macromolecules across is a different business, and as we hinted last time, it involves endocytosis. But we're going to talk instead about how you move small molecules, which involves a different mechanism. Now, there are many ways to classify transport, and there are three basic issues that usually come up. So let's explain what they are, and then we'll see how you use this. So when you consider it, transport, you say, does it need a protein? And if it does, how does the protein work? So it's the role of protein in this transport is sort of issue number one. Now, issue number two is, where do you get the energy to move a substance from one side of the membrane to another? So maybe this will be clearer if we make and draw what we're talking about. Suppose you have a membrane. Now, of course, this is a bilayer.
and you have compound X on side one, and you move it to side two. Now, we're not specifying inside or outside here. It can go either way. What we're just talking about is one side to the other. Some things go in, some things go out. Now, the first issue is, does it take a protein to do this? And if so, how does the protein work? So that's the protein part. Then there's the energy part. What is driving X across here? Now, the issue really is it just the concentration of X, or is there something else? And the third thing is the direction. Now, by this, I don't mean whether it's going in or out, although that's important. I mean something a little different. It often happens that you have more than one thing moving at a time. Now, the terms that I'm about to use are explained actually in your notes a little further on. There's a little table, so you can just listen and don't worry about writing it down. That sometimes you only move one thing at a time, and that's called uniport. Just like we wrote here. But sometimes two things are moving at the same time. We already met an example of this when we talked about the anion exchanger. Because you have to move bicarb and chloride. You can't move one or the other. You have to move both. Now, in that particular case, they go in opposite directions. Chloride goes one way, bicarb goes the other. So that's called antiport. Now, there is always the other possibility, which is that you have two things moving and they're both going in the same direction. And that is called symport. So antiport is opposite directions, symport is the same. Now, we haven't yet met any examples of this, but we will. Glucose and sodium are transported together into the cells of your epithelial cells. It turns out that the sodium drives the glucose, but you have to go together. So in that case, you have glucose and sodium, and they're both moving in the same direction, which is also called co-transport. That's an example of symport. Now, antiport is the anion exchanger. And the only other case that I want to talk about right now is a very famous protein. Is the protein involved in keeping the cation balance in your cells. And it moves sodium and potassium. This is called the sodium-potassium pump. This is a very important protein ion transporter, very important transport protein, and it moves the two ions in opposite directions. So this is another example of antiport. As we will see, it moves sodium generally out of the cell and potassium in. Now you notice I've called this protein a pump. The protein that moves glucose and sodium is called a co-transporter. We'll explain why that is. And the anion exchanger is called an exchanger for obvious reasons. Okay, so let's think of it in terms first of the protein involved. So if you look at that little flow chart at the top, the first big division there is whether you need a protein or whether you don't. So if you talk about transporting X, possibility one is that you don't need any protein. That's case one. And in your little table at the bottom, it has the properties of this kind of transport. If you need a protein, that's all the other cases two through five. So first let's look at one, and then we'll see how you split up two through five. Now, how could it be that you don't need a protein at all? We already know something that can pass a membrane that requires no help. Remember the anion exchanger? Well, we said you needed it to convert CO2 to bicarb. How does the CO2 get in and out of the cell? It just diffuses across a membrane. So gases and very small molecules, neutral ones, can in fact move across a membrane without any a protein. And the only other thing of any size that can move across a membrane is something which is soluble in lipid. So in fact, this is mostly gases and hydrophilic or lipid-soluble molecules. They essentially dissolve in the lipid part, sneak between the heads, the polar heads, dissolve in the lipid part, and exit the other side. Now, this turns out to be very important because some hormones, the steroid hormones, are lipid-soluble. Not all hormones, but some. So the hormones that are lipid-soluble, all hormones are signal molecules, and lipid-soluble hormones can diffuse into their target cells. This is not true of water-soluble hormones. Okay. In all other cases, except for gases, lipid-soluble compounds, and a few very small molecules, you need a protein to assist in transport. And this protein, again, can be of multiple types. And the first big division is what I've called case two and everything else. In case two, it acts as a channel. And in the others, it acts as a transporter. Now, the big difference is that a channel is immobile, basically. It's like an open door. Once it sits there open, anything that fits through can go through. But a transporter is more like a revolving door. It's more like something with moving parts. It's an allosteric protein, and when it binds the thing it's going to transport, it changes shape. So it essentially picks up what it's going to move on one side of the membrane, turns around, and dumps it at the other side of the membrane. It has moving parts. So it's quite different. It's acting sort of like an enzyme. It has to bind to that which it moves. Channels are quite different. Channels are basically sitting there waiting for something to move through. Now, for this reason, transporters are often considered to be like enzymes and to have a Km and a Vmax dependent on how well they bind what they move and how fast they can move it. But protein transporters are still subdivided into two major categories. And that's case three versus the other two. So one possibility is no protein. And then if it's a protein, it can be a channel or a transporter. And if it's a transporter, one possibility is that it just allows X to move down its gradient. So down gradient X. This is, again, very similar in explanation to the revolving door. A revolving door carries people from the side where there are a lot of people to the side where they aren't. And it can work either way. In the morning, you know, at 9 o'clock in the morning, I saw an awful lot of people getting off the subway and going through the turnstile. And I imagine around 5 or 6 o'clock, it would be the reverse if you could get in that turnstile. As it happens, you can't. But you can get in through the gate, but not the revolving one. So if you consider a revolving door, though, on a big commercial building, the revolving door goes one way. People pass through it in one direction in the morning and the other direction at the end of the day. But there is nobody standing there spinning the door. The only thing that moves the door is the people themselves who are moving through. And this is the same idea here. X moves from where it is high concentration to where it is low. And the other category is where you have something pushing the door. You have a source of energy from somewhere to push X around. So as a result, X goes up its gradient. X goes from where there's already a lot of it, where there is less of it, to where there is more. Now, in order to do this, that's why these are often called pumps. Now, people often call this one passive transport and this one active. Meaning that this one, passive, requires no input of energy, but active does. There has to be an input of energy from somewhere to shove the X up its gradient. Now the question is, where does the energy come from? Where does the energy always come from? ATP. So it comes from ATP, but either directly or indirectly. And that's the final two categories, 4 and 5. I'll draw them over here so they're easier to see. And these are called direct, often, and indirect. Or they're called primary and secondary active transport. Now, what we mean by direct is that you're actually splitting ATP and using that energy to drive transport, or the two processes are coupled directly. What we mean by indirect, on the other hand, is that the ATP is being used to drive some process, and then that process in turn is driving transport, so that the ATP is not directly involved. You needed to split ATP to set up the conditions, but then the conditions do it. And I'll explain that in a little bit more detail. And it's here, when we talk about indirect, that issues of symport and antiport come up. Because usually what happens in indirect is that ATP is used to create a gradient of something. Either sodium is the usual, but it can be something else. So the ATP is used to create a gradient of sodium, and then when the sodium runs down its gradient, that provides the energy to move X. Now that may provide the energy to drive X in the same direction, to carry it along, or that may provide the energy to kick X this way when the sodium is going that way. So this can be either symport or antiport, depending on whether sodium running down its gradient pushes things in the same or the opposite direction. Now, to make this just a little bit clearer, we can draw it in a slightly different way. That I drew here X going from side 1 to side 2. Now I can draw it in a slightly different way, where X goes from high concentration to low, or vice versa. So if X goes from high concentration to where X is in low concentration, this could be a channel, or there could be a transporter here, depending on what X is. In other words, we're saying it's one of these two cases. If X is going down its gradient, it's one or the other. Now, people use different terms for this depending on which book you read. Some people consider both of these to be in the same category because X is going down its gradient. Some people, though, say these are really very different in mechanism, which indeed they are. One is the revolving door, one is the open door. Even though it can be gated, the door can be closed, it's either open or it's shut, and that's it. But this one turns. So this one with the channel is sometimes simply called diffusion, because the top one, no protein, is simple diffusion. Here, once you put the channel in place, okay, diffuse away.
But some people think, no, that's not proper, because you need the protein of the channel or you don't diffuse anything. So this is sometimes called facilitated diffusion, or to be exactly careful, channel-mediated facilitated diffusion, or just channel-mediated transport. But both 2 and 3 are sometimes called facilitated diffusion. But they're very different in the way they work, because the facilitationer is very, very different. Whether it's just providing an open door or whether it is actually has moving parts. So facilitated diffusion can mean just 3. So I try and call it carrier-mediated facilitated diffusion so you won't get confused. And there are a few other terms that it's used for too. I think some of them are on the handout. This is all the second one. This is sometimes not only called carrier-mediated diffusion, but just carrier-mediated transport to keep it straight. So there's channel-mediated transport and carrier-mediated, but they're both down the gradient. So let me just add a few more cases here, and then we'll wrap it up and talk about how they work next time. That if X is going from high to low, then it's the concentration of X itself which is pushing X. Nothing else is being involved. But what if it's the other way around and X is going from low to high? Well, in that case, of course, you need a protein. We know that. So this is case either 3, this is case 4 or 5. This is some kind of active transport. And it's either direct active transport, because this process is linked to the hydrolysis of ADP, or it is indirect or secondary, because X low to X high is linked to sodium high going to sodium low. Now notice this does not imply which is in and which is out. This can be symport or antiport. But the point is that this compound, this ion, is going down its gradient, negative delta G, giving you energy, and that's used to push X up its gradient from low to high. Now let me just see if there are any choice words I wanted to fit here in at the end. Next time, no, I think what we're going to do next time is we're going to consider how you use all of these things to move them things around, and we're going to consider some examples. And in particular, we're going to discuss how transport is measured. How do you actually know which case you're dealing with, how fast it goes, what influences, etc. And we'll do that next time.